The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This week's podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance political journalist Marie Leconte.
This week's guest is James Ball, freelance writer and journalist. James began his career as chief reporter at The Grocer. He was then in-house journalist at WikiLeaks, a former data editor and special projects editor at The Guardian, was involved with their Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of the NSA leaks from Edward Snowden. Has anyone played you in a film?
Not in a film yet, alas. I got merged with a dude called Ziggy.
Ah, right. Well, I'm sure once the film of this podcast is made, you'll play a starring role. You were special correspondent at BuzzFeed, and your latest book is Bluffocracy. Welcome, James.
Thank you.
So, in the news this week, it's really difficult to know where to begin with so many small stories of relatively little significance. I thought we'd start with Tory donations. Tory donations. Official figures from the Electoral Commission showed that legacy payments from dead Tory donors were more than double those of their living members. 1.7 million paid in legacies in 2017. Do you think it's a problem for a party to have more dead members giving money than the living?
It feels like a solution to me, because you don't have to give them anything, or, you know, give them access or whatever. So just let me know, you're dying anyway, it's fine, you're dead. Just give us... I think it's good.
It's the cleanest money in politics, isn't it? It's also a brilliant political thriller. You know, political leader on the verge of losing power knows that the only way they'll have enough money to fight an election is to sort of have enough bequests, and so just starts targeting their own high value donors and bumping them off.
Hollywood, please. Itself, as with so many things, if that does now happen, first rights on royalties come to us. I'm not sure what the legal situation is. Are you allowed to stipulate when you give the money? If, for instance, I'm only doing this if we leave the EU, I'm only doing this if we remain in the EU, or does the money just get handed over? And also 1.6 or 1.7 million doesn't seem like a massive amount, given it's people's death.
What I'd like to know is if it's people who were really rich and so only gave a part of their money to the Conservative Party, or just like people who clearly just hated absolutely every single relative they've ever had and were like, fuck all of you, you know, whatever money I have, I'm just giving it. I'd rather give it to the Tories.
Yeah, their kids are like ardent Corbyn supporters or something. So they can stipulate that kind of stuff.
Okay.
It's on their executors rather than on the party.
Right.
But they could say, put this money into a trust, and if a political party, or if the Conservative Party does this, this and this, you must transfer it to them. It's your will. You can pretty much do what you want within reason.
I'm going to do that with Alan Mack. Any party that gets Alan Mack as a leader will get my money.
What of course is worth pointing out is the fact that these were payments from membership fees, not payments from donations. In fact, when it came to total raised income, Labour raised £56 million, which is £10 million more than the Tories in 2017. And so obviously the membership and the legacies takes up a very small part of that. Most is still donations. Does something need to be done about financing? We could probably cover this in the next couple of hours, do you think?
Honestly, it's, you know, unpopular opinion time. We should just publicly fund political parties, cap it at a certain amount, and say that they've got no reason to look for donors anymore. It would cost us a tiny fraction of what sort of the perception of corruption and the perception of doing favours for the boys does. I think that would be 40, 50 million a year well spent. Although, incidentally, Labour's sort of guilty or not guilty secrets, for a few years now, it's been in a way better financial position than the Tories, and it's got much better under Corbyn because they've got so much membership income. So it's not really an unfair fight, particularly at the moment. It's just, why have it at all?
Now, on the subject of membership, we recently had the story about entryism into the
That
into
was
the
actually
Conservative...
a smooth segue.
Yeah. Let's try not drawing attention to it. Like, it comes
was
naturally.
A smooth segue.
You once said, speaking free. Of nouns.
Yeah, I've moved on, you know, now that I have an agent who's, hawking me out everywhere. Anyway, under Tory party rules, Any member who's been a member for 3 months can vote in their leadership election. And so Leave.eu and some other groups have decided that they're going to organise an en masse entryist movement. They're going to get people to join the Conservatives in order to have a chance to vote in what they expect will be a forthcoming leadership election. Aaron Banks and Comedy Andy Wigmore have already tweeted out that they've joined, although the Conservative Party have denied this. So, you know, maybe they're making things up again. But do we really think this is a risk to the Tories or just an opportunity for a couple of thousand more pounds in membership fees?
I think it is actually a risk. I was talking to a few Tory activists actually about that in the past few days, and they're generally quite worried because, again, the membership is so small in the Tories, and, you know, and they don't really have that thing. So I think in the Labour Party and the CLPs quite a lot, there'll always be a core group of people who are really good at kind of like organising and out-organising other factions, etc. The Tories don't do it to the same extent. So I think that if a lot of people join, they're kind of worried they'll not be able to outsmart them, basically, you know, if there are deselection threats or, you know, stuff like that. But also the one thing I'll say, which I think is quite interesting, is that apparently some Labour moderates have privately been in touch with kind of like quite wet Tories to be like, look, we've been through this for the past 2 years. If you want to get in touch and actually we can have a chat so you don't make the mistakes that we made over the past 2 years, we can probably help.
That sounds like an intervention. Are they staging an intervention? that would make for great TV.
It kind of just serves to remind the Tories how divided they are at the moment. They're really sort of struggling having a party that can fit Anna Soubry and, you know, Nicky Morgan and sort of that crowd and Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson and co. as it is. And so sort of reminding them that most of UKIP's membership and support came from the Conservatives in the first place. It's not that healthy for sort of party dynamics at the time, but they're going to have that fight whether or not a whole bunch of new members join anyway. So they probably should just take the members.
And one party, of course, that's not divided is the Lib Dems, who are having their own discussions over leadership. So there's been speculation that Vince Cable may or may not make an announcement that may or may not talk about the fact that he will be making way for somebody else at some stage in the future, possibly 2020, and that the rules will be changed to allow people who are not MPs to be leaders. Now, if you were being cynical, you might say that was because of the small number of MPs that they have and the quality of the candidates they have to draw on. What do we think will happen with that?
I think like two quick things. The first thing is that I remember, so a few years ago now, so pre the general election, the Lib Dems were already talking about this idea of like trying to find someone who was not an MP. So that's not something that's come out of nowhere. That was interrupted, I think, as a plan by the 2017 snap election, but they were already kind of like having private chats over the possibility of getting someone who's not a Lib Dem. And the second thing I'll say is that, so I think, so the thinking seems to be that actually, if Vince makes a speech around the 7th of September, I believe, is the date. Basically, because Lib Dem leadership contests take so long because they're Lib Dems. And so I think we're genuinely, I can't remember how many weeks, but it is a stupid amount of weeks from the announcement to the actual leadership contest taking place. Actually, they don't have a lot of time left to do it if they want to do it before Brexit Day. And so I think that that's the kind of thinking. If that happens very soon, that means they'll probably want a new leader before Brexit Day.
I mean, didn't Andy Warhol say in the future everyone will be Lib Dem leader for 15 minutes?
And surprise, James, tomorrow.
So, well, Maria, I think you're up for December this year.
Oh, but it's my birthday.
I know, but you got holiday cover. Sorry.
So everyone will get their chance because they don't need to be MPs or indeed Lib Dems at all. Gina Miller is one of the names that's being bandied.
Yeah,
about.
And Remain keeps wondering why it fails to connect with anyone. It's, you know, Gina Miller is your sort of face of winning back over an unconvinced sort of public on the Europe, you're well, going to lose.
Particularly when there's always June Sarpong still available.
The voice of youth.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a brilliant idea. Hear me out. Rachel Johnson joined the Lib Dems last year.
And she's now unemployed.
Yes. And yeah, exactly. She's just lost her column for the Mail on Sunday. The idea of another Johnson becoming a party leader before Boris would just be so funny. So I will be starting my campaign for Rachel Johnson as leader of the Liberal Democrats today. You heard it here first.
This is possibly the only thing that could ever make me join the Liberal Democrats. I would vote for that.
You heard it here first and I imagine last as well. So Rachel Johnson for leader. And speaking of unlikely leadership candidates, Nigel Farage, he's been in the news recently. He has claimed that he's plotting a political comeback. He said on Twitter, "I'll have no choice but to return to frontline politics if Brexit is delayed beyond March 2019. To which our good friend Ralph Little replied, "And I'll have no choice but to return to the International Space Station, where I have also never been." It's important to me because the work by David Griffiths, exhibited in a recent exhibition organised by Grayson Perry, his portrait of Nigel Farage, priced at £25,000, failed to attract any interest. How much do we think you would pay for a portrait of Nigel Farage? Because in the same exhibition, a portrait by Paul Selle of Jacob Rees-Mogg sold for £450. presumably to Jacob Rees-Mogg himself. What do you think? What's a good value? What's a good price for a portrait of Nigel? And what do you think the audience for that is? Who's the customer base?
I feel like I would probably spend up to £35 on it, specifically to send it to a friend on their birthday. And they'll be like, "Oh my God, a massive present. What is it?" Because I'd be like, you know, be in the house in those times. Something big is arriving. And, you know, and kind of maybe while they're having a party or something, and then it arrives and boom, it's a massive portrait of Nigel Farage.
Jim Picard over the Financial Times has said that Farage plans to run for mayor of London. So,
I mean, and that's a terrifying risk for London, where UKIP surged to fifth place last time on 3%.
Yeah, well, 3.6%. I think when you get under 5%, you have to count the 0.6. UKIP don't have a strong track record in London. It did vote 60% Remain. And in 2012, UKIP actually put the wrong name on the ballot paper for the mayoral election, calling themselves Fresh Choice for London, which I always thought sounded like a really bad slogan for a gym membership. James, have you ever wanted a painting of yourself?
Oh, God, no. I would pay a lot of money not to have one.
Marie?
So there are weirdly like quite a high amount of paintings of myself in existence.
All of them in my flat.
I would have said any number greater than zero. It would be a weird number.
I mean, it's a bit, you know, so like my grandmother's a painter. There are about 7 portraits of me in existence. And she keeps trying to be like, "Why don't you take one?" Like, so she's in front, take one, you know, put it in your bedroom, something. And obviously I can't say that, but I'm like, "Grandma, if I bring someone home," and I'm like, "Hey, so this is me, this is a painting of me who's going to watch us have sex." Like,
What age are you in these paintings? Have you got, I can't imagine anything, I can't imagine a better form of contraception than over your own bed, a picture of you as a child looking down on you.
They go from age about, you know, sort of like 4 to 17.
Wow.
So, yeah.
How many before we can actually organise some sort of gallery?
I don't even.
I got the Reedy exhibition. Yeah.
Marie, yeah. Count the Lacans.
Okay, we have to
crowdfund. Is that an original Lacan?
So, and yeah, if you go to GoFundMe.com, you will be able to contribute to this valuable exhibition as soon as you hear this podcast.
Yeah, it's not as if GoFundMe hasn't been used for Stranger Things more recently. But moving on, I want to talk about Theresa May's dancing. Now, obviously, there were two stories with regards to Theresa May's tour of Africa over the weekend. Michael Crick gave her a tough series of questions about what she personally had done at the time when Margaret Thatcher was referring to Nelson Mandela as a terrorist. That obviously didn't go down well. But perhaps even worse was the footage of her dancing with school children in Cape Town on the first day of her visit. Writing in The Independent, Martha Gill described it as, she said she dances like a very well-meaning wardrobe being shifted up a staircase. Her critics were less kind. The Guardian questioned whether this was a threat to international diplomacy. James, are you a good dancer?
I'm an enthusiastic dancer, and frankly, that's half the battle.
Well, would you say you like or dislike dancing?
I thoroughly enjoy it.
Oh, well, that's interesting, because only just over a third of men, 36%, do say they...
That's because quite a lot of men make the poor lifestyle choice to be straight. and so for them, dancing means sort of aggressively moving your shoulders and nothing below them.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
Yes, I do.
Would you say you are a good dancer, though? Good or bad dancer? Where would you rank yourself? And we can include average in this.
So I would say fractionally above average if we exclude straight men, because otherwise just anyone who can actually move their hips gets like a 9 out of 10.
Only 6% of men of all descriptions describe themselves as either good or great dancers. Marie, where do you fall on the dancing floor?
So actually, fun fact, my mum used to be a belly dance teacher, and so I used to kind of like tag along with it. Belly dancing?
I thought you said that. I wondered if for the first time your French accent was coming out and you actually said ballet dancing. You actually said belly dancing.
She was. But no, as in, you know, but not in the tacky way. Like, obviously, like, she's rocking.
Heaven forbid belly dancing would be tacky.
No, I'm sorry. Okay, we're not going to have a like chat about weird racism here, but like, genuinely, but no, it's like, it's a proper, like, legitimate, like, dance around, obviously, like, across the Arab world. Anyway, and it closed most of the time. So, anyway.
That microaggression aside.
I would say I'm a pretty good dancer, and also same as James, I think I quite enjoy it and I'm just a very enthusiastic person.
Well, so 75% of women like dancing, but only 14% of them describe themselves as either good or a great dancer. I am a terrible dancer.
Your limbs are too long.
Well, it's very kind of you.
Like, I actually feel a bit sorry for Theresa May for the first time in history. Two times when actually being a human prime minister might have helped her. Sort of on the dancing, like, she actually did it for once rather than
fair play to her.
Like,
she did do it rather than.
That is less awkward than just standing and looking weird.
Exactly. Rather than freezing up in a Maybot way, she did actually give it a go. Yeah,
she should have done the robot.
Also, oh my God, Theresa May doing the robot would be the greatest.
I would describe her as she has to be dragged onto the dance floor, which places her with one in five women and nearly one in four. Men.
I like that this has been the most statistically rigorously researched segment of the show.
Yeah, it's amazing what Google can throw up.
On the Michael Crick thing, though, just sort of briefly.
Like, I don't have data on Michael Crick. So, do you think he's a good dancer?
He's a phenomenal dancer.
I reckon what do you reckon, MLC? I think Crick's probably can crack it out.
I don't know. I feel like he clearly has a lot of energy, as we see, you know, when he cricks people, eventually. Yeah. So I reckon that, yeah. He'd be a good dancer.
I think he'd be happy to dance, but only once others are. You know,
first on the floor.
You think only 4% of men are first on the floor, so Crick would be very much in a minority if that were the case. But we're not ruling it out.
But, you know, just briefly tackling his journalism.
But Jesus Christ, James.
Any normal, sane human being who is faced with, hey, were you on the wrong side of history on the apartheid when everyone knows what the answer was? You go, I'm a human being. I've been wrong about a lot of things. I've learned that. I've changed. There are some other things I've done that on, and, you know, I hope to carry on doing that. That's a normal, sane answer that gets you out of it, instead of just trying to dance around the point in this weird sort of... It was
what's important
odd.
Is the UK's response.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say that...
So the UK's response at the time was terrible from a government that, you know, was your party.
God, yeah. I love that, you know, so like, was I wrong? Yes. But was the country wrong? Also, yes.
Yeah, it's not just me. It's also my whole political party, including several people who are still around and related to my government.
I might have been racist, but so were some of my best friends. Moving quickly away from that, our main topic for this podcast is one that I think we can all join in on as I sit here on this chaise longue. And that's social class in Britain, specifically with its role in journalism. It was during a speech at the Edinburgh TV Festival that Jeremy Corbyn said he wanted the social class of BBC British content creators to be published. Now, he's criticised for this. The Daily Mail described it as class war on the BBC. It's a pretty strange thing to ask for. But James, you wrote really, I'm not just saying this because you're here, but you did write a really, really good piece about how you were the first in your family to do A-levels, the first to go to university, and you've crafted a successful career for yourself in the world of writing and journalism. Marie, you've also come to journalism as an outsider. Do you guys think that journalism has a class problem in this country? And what about the BBC specifically?
Yes and yes. I mean, the sort of the funny thing with both Jeremy Corbyn's suggestion and the outraged response to it was the BBC already published this data. As lots of people pointed out, whatever kind of class you start out as, by the time you are sort of working in national journalism, even if you don't have a particularly nice salary, you have a middle class pattern of life. So it's more about where you started out versus where you are now. And we've got to admit that, you know, most of us make enough money to have a relatively nice life, even if, you know, owning a one-bed flat is an impossible dream. But the BBC sort of try and look at stuff like, were you sort of state educated or privately or public school? Did your parents go to university? Fairly reasonable measures to try and get a rough idea of it. Yes, journalism has a massive class problem, and it gets worse sort of the further you get into it. As you sort of go into local and trades journalism, where I started out, my background was pretty standard, as my background is pretty standard nationally. You know, I didn't grow up in grinding poverty. I just had a fairly normal sort of working / lower middle class upbringing.
How would you describe your class?
I mean, I live in Islington. I'm middle class.
Constantly landed gentry. But,
you know, neither of my parents own a home. I don't have an inheritance coming. My brother and sister left school before they were 16. That's not that unusual unless you work in the media. And like the eerie thing in the media is how many people refer to themselves as middle class when their families are actually solidly in the top 1%. And what's regarded as normal, and this is sort of the dangerous thing, people look around at their social groups, they look around at their background, and because they weren't sort of taking private jets everywhere and stuff, they think that's what the middle is. Sort of in this country, average full-time salary is less than £30,000. If someone earns £45,000, they're in the top 15%. And so these kind of sort of measures are just nowhere near the lived experience of almost anyone. And there's a ton of stuff going on about it. But journalism has a massive class problem. One thing I wish we would stop talking about is the very stupid Sutton Trust report about 100 top journalists. Like, it's a really flawed report, and it means everyone just argues about the statistics of this one report, which says 51% of top journalists were privately educated. Why don't we just pay not very much money for a better survey of it and drop the rubbish figures and also drop the excuse to not really talk about it? Also, sorry, I've monologued here, but the worst thing about the class in journalism debate is it's usually used just as a reason not to listen to someone you don't want to. So anytime the left want to ignore a piece I write, they just say, oh, another public school sort of posh idiot. It's like, no, I'll have you know, I'm a Northern State school, not very posh idiot. Thank you very much. There's some pretty good left-wing writers who are wildly posh. There's some pretty good right-wing writers who really sort of worked up from, you know, pretty sort of normal or working-class backgrounds. Instead of just using it as a stick to sort of beat people with, if we actually care about it, the stuff we can do to fix it, you know, bring apprenticeships back, more kind of grants and bursaries for sort of BME, LGBT, low income sort of backgrounds, you know, we can do quite a lot to fix it. But instead, we just use it as a reason to shout at each other on Twitter. And I'm kind of done with that.
Speaking of shouting at each other on Twitter, the writer Dan Harrison questioned Owen Jones's working class credentials when he said, if Owen Jones is so working class, has he ever eaten a potato, watched You've Been Framed, firebombed a corner shop, taken a car for an MOT, refused to eat a salad, crossed a picket line, bought a cast record, shouted sexual abuse at a random woman? The man's a complete fake.
I tell you the one thing that really sodding annoys me about most of the British media: having a northern accent and being working class are not the same sodding thing. And like,
sorry, hang on, I'm just going to... just making a note of that. Sorry, carry on.
So, and like, Owen, to his credit, has never claimed to have a working class background, because he doesn't. He's just got a better... he's kept a better northern accent than I have. I'm slightly
Can you still do, and indeed have you had cause to do a particularly working class sounding accent in at times?
I believe you have once again confused working class and northern. If I go back to Yorkshire or talk to my family, my accent comes back in very sort of full force. I cannot now convincingly fake one down here, but it does snap back in.
I'd like to add that I guess one of the things, and I think it's not just about the class debate in journalism, it kind of happens whenever privilege gets discussed, like the reason why there's so much pushback when people say, you know, talk about social class in journalism, is that people kind of hear it as a sort of, you know, because you're posh or because you're quite well educated, you did not work hard to get there. So then you get all the journalists on Twitter saying, actually, you know, I think you'll find I worked bloody hard to get to where I am day in, day out from age, you know, whatever. When actually, you know, that's not the point that's being made. Actually, you know, no one is denying the fact that actually, I think if you want to get to the top in journalism, you will have to be like have been a very, very hard worker. So I think that's the first thing. And the second one is one quick way as well to change the sorts of people who get the jobs is to make the processes more formal. So I think it was Dan Knowles actually from The Economist pointed out, he was like, look, I have never, you know, I've never been hired. I think he's like, I've never had a like formal job interview. I've never had to write a proper CV. I'm the same. You know, I've been very lucky because I don't necessarily come from, you know, these circles, but somehow I have managed to mostly get jobs basically without having a CV. I've had obviously a few formal job interviews, but that's that. So I think that, you know, just advertising jobs, for example, in journalism would be a massive thing, you know, with proper qualifications and saying, okay, well, you know, if you've got X and Y qualifications, apply and then come into the office, we'll have a proper chat about how good you'd be at the job. Whereas, you know, now it is very much, you know, normally just friends or friends of friends. And actually, even the few jobs that are advertised, often enough, you'll find that that newsroom already has someone in mind and they just have to advertise it for HR purposes.
What about the Spectator's approach of asking simply for writing and not asking for CVs?
I think it's got a couple of upsides. Like, they have taken some quite sort of non-conventional candidates and actually just saying, prove you can do it. And sort of treating it as completely applicant blind, experience blind, etc. There's quite a lot to be said for it, but it's not sort of a perfect fix. Like, firstly, a lot of people who come from outside a system are the ones most likely to try and get the piece of paper and the formal qualification. You kind of, if you don't know how journalism works, you really focus on the idea of credentials. You know, the idea of having a journalism sort of degree for me seemed essential, so I got one. And so to then throw that out can actually sort of damage people, and also it makes it impossible for you to try and do any kind of positive discrimination. Now, since I think The Spectator would be vanishingly unlikely to ever do that, application blind and actually paying a, you know, paying internships is, you know, crucial here, is good. But it puts a lot of labour on the person doing the application. Like, that Spectator thing wants you to edit two pieces, write three short pieces, suggest 10 pieces. It's a massive amount of work for an application. And if each one required that, that's a really unreasonable amount of labour. So I like the idea. I think it's an interesting one and it's an interesting thing to have in the mix, but it's not a kind of perfect solution.
Now, I don't want to get all polling geek on us, well, not too much.
You talking about polling?
Yeah, exactly. Just imagine. But for me, there's a really big question about how you measure social class, because the way that we do it in the strange world of political research is very different from the way that that other people do it.
Well, no sociologist would ever, ever let you get away with calling A, B, C, 1, C, 2, D, E any kind of social class measurement. It's literally just a consumption.
Yes, like, yeah, exactly. Well, that system that you refer to was actually developed for the National Readership Survey more than 50 years ago. A, B, C1, that's generally counted as, in inverted commas, middle class. And then C2, D, E is working class.
I mean, given you put pensioners in E, who are often richer than a lot of the Bs and C1s, well, this is the thing. It's
not,
mad.
It's not to do with, what a lot of people don't realise, is it's not to do with income. Let's say you're Harry Kane, for instance. You're on relatively good money. I think we can all agree. So you're Harry Kane, you're on hundreds of thousands of pounds a week, and yet in those strict classifications, you are a skilled manual worker, which puts you as a C2. Now, that admittedly, very skilled, very well paid, but you are still on the scale below AB and C1, which I think is very interesting. And of course, A, among those are university professors who may be earning very, very little money in their ivory tower, but still put themselves at A, given that it was academics that helped come up with this classification in the first place.
Well, it is completely out of date, because it was sort of meant to be more to do with how people spent their money and who they associated with. It was for advertisers and subscribers, but the way people spend now, kind of, especially Group E, which kind of lumps together people who are living on out-of-work benefits with some very rich pensioners, it makes absolutely no sense either for its stated purpose or really as any measure of social class.
Yeah, and the way you measure it as well has changed. It, when 50 years ago, when this started for the National Readership Survey, face-to-face interviewers would go into people's homes and were meant to ask them a series of questions about their level of responsibility, the type of job they did, all that sort of thing. But essentially what they do would just be to have a look round, look at the fixtures and fittings. You were trained to do this as a face-to-face researcher. You'd have a look round, you think, oh, right, well, there's that over there, there's that, I'll put them down as a C1, et cetera, et cetera. the idea that things like, as you said, accent didn't come into it is of course ridiculous for some people. Of course, I speak as someone with a standard British accent, and so it's assumed that I went to public school, which is simply not true. I went to a stabby comprehensive, and perhaps we can have a working class off later.
Everyone loves one of those.
But I do find it really interesting. Speaking of working class offs, what percentage of the British people, because this is, of course, the other way that you can measure social class, what percentage of the British people do you think believe they're working class?
Oh, I think I knew this one. Is it somewhere around like 42%?
I think it's around there too, because there's quite a lot of people who are blatantly middle class who, they always phrase it the same way as well. They go, well, I've got to work for a living, so I guess I'm working class.
50% of Brits believe themselves to be working class, including nearly 40%, 39% of ABC ones. Yeah.
Well, it's also, we have this completely barking system where unless you're literally landed gentry or above, no one is ever going to say upper.
Well, that's
so
right.
We have a system that puts everyone, including most people, into 1% as middle.
Only 1% of people describe themselves as upper class. You've got 40% saying middle class and then 10% saying don't know. Marie, when the British people were asked which class is the best class to be in, what do you think they said?
Oh, God. Your people are really weird. So, I don't know. Oh, God. They'd say working class, wouldn't they? Because I feel like they'd just be like, ooh, actually, if I say middle, like, ooh, I might have been seen as elitist.
What do you think, James?
I have a horrible feeling that I've said working.
I would have thought the same thing. I would have thought the same thing for the same reasons that you articulated. In actual fact, and it's not overwhelming by any means, it's middle class. 27% of people said that middle class is the best class to be in. 16% said working class. 13% upper class. 20% said none of them.
I love the complete delusion of this country where only 1 in 8 of us will admit it would be great to be like rich and have massive land and stuff. Yeah, like,
we why have a would problem. I want everything?
Yeah, for the I record, if I
all the money and power. Yeah, no. We're mad. We are so self-delusional.
You are.
Producer Nick here, just briefly interrupting this chat to speak to Carl McGrath from Ladbrokes. So Carl, on this week's episode, we were discussing the Lib Dem leadership contest that isn't quite, but might be or might not be. Are punters having any interest in the excitement around Vince Cable's possible speech at Lib Dem conference?
Yes, it's been quite a popular market actually over the last couple of days. So obviously with Vince Cable's announcement that they're going to open up the leadership to candidates outside of just MPs, the obvious candidate was Gina Miller. So she was added to the betting at around 8-1. She's drifted slightly now to about 10-1 with her somewhat ruling herself out. But obviously that may not count for too much. And she was quite a popular selection immediately after that. But actually, and probably surprisingly, the most popular selection has been Ed Davey. He's been backed in from 12-1 into 6-1, which, as I said, is somewhat surprising given the fact that he was first elected as an MP 21 years ago. I mean, it goes completely against the idea of opening the election up to new and fresher candidates, really.
But you've still got Jo Swinson as your favourite.
Yeah, she's been quite a steady favourite for the last few months, around about 5-6. She's drifted slightly from what she was a couple of days ago, but she's still a pretty solid favourite, with Leila Moran just behind her at 2-1, again pretty steady.
In a way, the more figures like Gina Miller move up the betting and the more that you get drift on Jo Swinson or Leila Moran, the sort of better those bets look.
Yeah, so you could argue that. I mean, Jo Swinson has been the elected candidate really for several months now. So it could be that she may drift towards evens within the next week or so. And that could well look a good value bet in the next few months.
But Vince Cable has posted on Instagram that he's not standing down anytime soon. So people are not going to get a very immediate return on their bet. A more immediate return would be in the Green leadership, which seems to me not a very exciting race given that everyone thinks they know who's going to win.
Unfortunately, it's very much the case. So, I mean, the favourites, John Bartley and Sean Berry, are now 1-12. And they've actually shortened up slightly over the last couple of days from 1-10. It does seem to be a closed heat. We've taken very little money on the two outside candidates. Unfortunately, so I mean, the betting would suggest that it's very much a close case at the moment.
The other role that's going to be up for grabs is London Mayor, and today we're seeing the Sadiq Khan balloon floating over London. Is he still the favourite to win the next mayoral election?
Yes, he's still, I mean, comfortably favourite at the moment, around about 1-3. He's actually drifted slightly in the betting based on the popularity of Sean Bailey over the last week. So Sean Bailey was actually marginally second favourite to Andrew Bough in the race to win the Tory vote, but he's proven quite popular over the last week. He's now into 5-2 in the mayoral race, but it still very much suggests that Sadiq Khan is a heavy favourite for that.
And how about Nigel Farage, who it was reported is considering running for London Mayor? Is he appealing to any bettors?
So he's been added to the betting today at 16-1. So it's still very much early stakes. We've seen some money for him, and I'd imagine we'd probably see quite a bit over the next few weeks, judging on previous elections. But I'd say the odds of 16-1 opening suggest and probably reflect the fact that we don't see him at this moment as a direct threat, mainly because there's no guarantee that he will actually run. If he were to announce he definitely is running, you'd probably see those odds shorten up fairly significantly.
Thanks, Kyle. And you can get all of those odds and markets on the Ladbrokes website or the Ladbrokes app. Now, back to everyone in the studio.
And finally then, moving on to other stuff. James, are you a dog or a cat person?
Cat.
Really? And what percentage of the British public do you think are a cat person?
I'm going to go about 40%.
Ooh, so you think cat person will win out over dog person?
I think it'll be close, but dog person will win.
Marie, what do you think?
Well, I'm a dog person, and I'd say that probably like there are more dog people than cat people.
Correct. Dog people, 45%. Cat people, 31%, and neither 21%, which is definitely me.
I was going to say, we could, you know, not to get too Brexity, but we could deport the sort of neither people.
I think that's completely unfair.
I believe you will find we are a nation of animal lovers, and if you're not going to sign up to British
surely
values...
Surely there must be an animal you like.
I like all the animals I can eat.
But like, would you pet them beforehand?
If I had to, I'd pet them aggressively in order to lead to the next stage of our relationship.
Oh God, take that out.
I think being neither is a perfectly reasonable position to take. I don't really like animals of any kind.
Fish, how about fish?
I like eating fish. What I found interesting was the party differences on this. Conservative Labour, firmly dog people. Lib Dems, cat people.
Oh God, I'm revising my opinion on cats.
It's remarkable, the turnaround. I don't know what it is about Lib Dems that lends themselves to that, but there we go.
I thought that'd lead to a joke, but
I hoped it would. And for the last couple of hours, I've been thinking of one, but we've run out of time.
Is there as good as finding leaders?
No,
not going to work.
It's coming to something when you can't make a Lib Dem joke. I mean, that's that's the state of modern politics.
yeah, exactly. Thanks, Brexit. Thank you very much, James. The book is Bluffocracy, available from all good Amazons. We'll be back next week. I'm afraid there was no time for our interview with Dominic Raab, but there is just time for a quick look at Tub, the new podcast mascot.
Adorable.
Mm. Okay, thanks everyone. See you next week.
It's a cold man that will be mean to a dog, like in its house.
Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.